never heard of him. No, kid. He's great.
I think he's a very good opinion column writer. Very steady, thoughtful. He does not represent my point of view a lot of the time. I read him pretty regularly.
Yeah, I will go one better. Along with Paul Wells, I kind of hold him and have held him for a long time as the archetype of a good Canadian columnist, which is they have hobby horses, they have strong opinions, but they don't take sides predictably, and they're willing to ruffle feathers. I love his fondness for congestion pricing. Big fan of that. You know, as a columnist, you got to have your little peccadillos and hobby horses, but...
He's a weirdo monarchist. And one thing that I count on him for is never to have dumb takes. Except for last week. We would not dedicate a full segment to simply praise Andrew Coyne. Here's what he wrote last week. The opinion column's title was "The Right's New Cause, Crime Without Punishment and Its New Martyrs, the Ottawa Hostage Takers." And I'll read from this. This is how it begins. If there is one thing Canada's conservatives believe in, it is getting tough on crime. Wherever there is a debate on what penalty should be imposed for criminal offenses, conservatives stand squarely and proudly for more. Whether as a matter of deterrence or simple retribution, conservatives almost always favor longer sentences rather than shorter. Except, it seems, when the criminals involved are their friends. Take, for example, Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, organizers of the notorious Freedom Convoy that took much of downtown Ottawa hostage for 3 weeks in 2022. They are folk heroes to the populist right. So here is this argument that conservatives are hypocrites. Coyne is saying that these conservatives who are constantly banging on, they want blood, they think that we're too easy on criminals, except when it's their heroes. Right now, there is an uproar on the conservative Canadian internet because the Crown is seeking a sentence of 7 years in prison for Tamara Leach and 8 years in prison for Chris Barber, who've been convicted of mischief. Not that they're going to get it. I want to just start by saying that is not a good argument. It is entirely possible to simultaneously believe that we need harsher penalties for crime and that whatever penalties we have should be handed out fairly. Those are not incompatible arguments.
They're not, but I'm not sure that's the argument that folks like Pierre Polyev or Melissa Lantzman are making. They rarely intervene, which is as it should be. Politicians should not, as a matter of course, be commenting on sentence duration or sentence severity. They should let the criminal justice system do its job. And yet they are weighing in here on behalf of these two people, not because I think that they have a principled view as much as because these people are heroes within a large segment of their political base, and they were getting yelled at for not speaking out more forcefully on their behalf. And I think it just speaks to the chumminess between Polyev and this sort of convoy movement. I wrote, gosh, I think it was almost 2 years ago now, a column where I said the Conservative Party is now the convoy party of Canada. That is what defines them. That is what unites and binds them as an issue more than low taxes or small government. And I think that is the hypocrisy that Coyne is pointing to there. I don't think it's an unreasonable argument for him to make. As a columnist, hypocrisy is just such a delicious treat to snack on. And I think that's what he was doing there. You can take issue with the duration of the sentences that were requested by the Crown. I'm sure we'll get into that. But I do think the hypocrisy is worth calling out because it is right there in plain view.
Let me make sure I understand you. It's the hypocrisy of the politicians specifically that you think is in question, not... There is a widespread outrage amongst conservatives that while they see certain protests go unpoliced and there's not an enforcement of the law, and they're also constantly and sometimes reasonably outraged at some really light sentences that some very serious criminals are getting in Canada, and then they see their political hero here, Tamara Leach, they dropped all of the most serious charges, and now it's like mischief for like counseling others to obstruct justice. And Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, it should be pointed out, were not authors of the memorandum of understanding, that one that let's overthrow the Canadian government, whatever the hell that was about. The outrage that Leach's supporters have over the perceived hypocrisy or double standards of the justice system. That's not what Coyne is aiming at here. He's aiming at a different hypocrisy.
It's the hypocrisy of speaking out only when their own supporters are the ones who are under the eye of the criminal justice system. I don't recall Pierre Polyev or Melissa Lantzman or any of these other MPs speaking out when left-wing protesters have been convicted of mischief and the Crown has sought longer sentences, which Coyne details in that piece, that there have been people in the past who blockaded fossil fuel projects or what have you, and they were similarly pursued by prosecutors. Pierre Polyev didn't say a word about that. In fact, I would assume that he was very supportive of that, probably wanted them to have longer sentences.
Yeah.
That is the inconsistency.
I see.
It is not that you are standing up for pure virtue of the criminal justice system. It is that you feel like these particular people are being railroaded. And that's just not consistent with a party that claims to care about justice, about getting tough on crime, all these other things that only seem to apply to people who don't share their politics.
Okay, I understand now, and that makes sense. But are these people getting railroaded?
I don't know if they're being railroaded. I think the sentences that are being requested strike me as being disproportionate. I've certainly talked to lawyers and crowns, and I think they still imagine that they are part of a system where the courts were not political and things like social media didn't really exist or matter. And we are just not in that world anymore. And they have to consider, I think, the way these requested sentences look to the public. Because at the end of the day, if the public does not believe in and buy into the criminal justice system, we are in a very bad place. And there are people out there who will weaponize these sorts of issues for engagement, bad faith actors. Like, they exist, and you have to reckon with them. And so if you're a crown and you're requesting 7 years in prison for mischief, and some other crown has requested 4 years for sexual assault or murder or any of the other things that have been compared to this, you are going to look out of touch. And I think that is a risk they have to start factoring in. I think these people, Barber and Leach, they should absolutely serve time. But they don't need to serve 7 or 8 years. That feels wildly excessive to me. I don't think the judge is going to give them that.
I do think it's worth putting this in context, Max, and this is something that Andrew Coyne points out. The requested sentence from the Crown is very different than what they're likely to get when they are sentenced this coming fall. And just for comparison's sake here, I'll read from a Global News report. In a separate Ottawa-based trial for Pat King, another convoy leader, the Crown sought a sentence of 10 years in prison for mischief and disobeying a court order. So that's comparable. They asked for a huge sentence. What did he get? King was sentenced in February to 3 months of house arrest, 100 hours of community service at a food bank or men's shelter, and a year of probation. He received 9 months credit for time served before his conviction.
But even requesting it just gives the bad faith actors who want to undermine and politicize these things, it gives them stuff to work with. It reminds me of the Christian musician, and I refuse to remember his name because he's not important, but the guy who had his concerts interfered with by Parks Canada.
Arise and shine!
This is Sean Foyt, an evangelical Christian musician associated with the pro-Trump MAGA movement. His Canadian tour is off to a rocky start, as permits were revoked for his first 3 shows due to public outcry. First Halifax, then Charlottetown, and now Moncton.
In opposing him, they made him a far bigger celebrity, a far bigger influence than he would have been otherwise. And the reason that happened is because bureaucrats, public servants, what have you, didn't realize the world they were living in. They didn't understand the media environment, the informational environment they're in right now, and they stepped on a rake they didn't have to. And I think that's the same thing here with the Crown.
But the reason why they're seeking these excessive sentences has to do with the perception of Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, an enduring perception that actually that Andrew Coyne contributed to and was wrong, technically wrong. Like, he was in favor of Trudeau using the Emergency Act to suspend civil liberties across the nation. That did happen, and said that this was the best option available. And a federal court later ruled that a charter violation.
The federal court has ruled the Liberal government's decision to invoke the Emergencies Act amid the trucker protests in Ottawa in 2022 violated Canada's charter.
That's not a small thing when the federal government violates our Charter of Rights and Freedoms to crack down on a protest movement. So that opinion, at least according to the courts, was a wrong opinion. But there is still like this two solitudes thing happening around the convoy. Max, I want to like take a step back here to step on a rake that I don't have to. I've already taken the hit I've already taken the hit for this. I've already said some of these things before, but I think about it more and more. And I'll take the hit again because, like, you have to admit when you're wrong. Stick around because after the break, I'm going to explain how I got things wrong when it comes to the convoy and why. I was wrong about the convoy. In the lead up to the convoy, I'll defend my wrongness here, or at least explain it. We had been documenting for years the rise of really scary white supremacy groups in Canada and the confluence of the Yellow Vests and Diagonal and the Proud Boys and all this shit, and it was very real. Here's an expert on the topic, Dr. Barbara Perry, talking about the rise of these kinds of groups back in 2019.
The presence, the increasing presence and visibility and vocal nature of the organized hate movement, white nationalist groups, white supremacist groups, those sorts of things. When we published our first study, the far right in Canada, we identified just about 100 active groups across the country. And we're now sort of on the second stage of that research, and already, just 4 years later, we're estimating well over 200, probably approaching 300 active groups across the country.
And we're watching these things happen. We're digging into their philosophies. We know that they're sort of two-faced about what they put on their public face, but what they talk about in chat rooms. We're increasingly reporting about this and getting more and more worried that this might blow over into something truly violent. We watch January 6th. Where it does do that in the States.
Pro-Trump groups and mobs in the streets stand off with police. We are also learning that today's insurrection has turned deadly. A woman was pronounced dead at a hospital after apparently being shot on Capitol grounds amidst this.
Never should have happened. Absolutely a betrayal of everything that country is supposed to represent. This was violence and mob rule. And then we see a convoy of trucks with fellow travelers of that culture heading to Ottawa.
A trucker's convoy rolls into the nation's capital.
The nation's capital is being characterized as a city under siege.
With this wackadoodle memorandum of understanding, which, like, seems to suggest that there's the possibility for violence. And when you have that kind of context, you know, we usually think of context as a good thing. Like, I was ready for and I predicted that this was going to be our January 6th.
There is nothing I would rather be arrested for than fighting for freedom in my country.
The time has come for you to take down the barricades, stop the disruptive action.
We love you guys. We love you in the name of Jesus Christ, and we love your souls.
Breaking news. Police are moving in, arresting demonstrators this morning. At least 10 people have been arrested.
By far the biggest show of force we've seen from Ottawa police so far. There are multiple units here along with tactical teams.
I predicted that this was going to be our January 6th. And at some point, we have to admit, it wasn't. It wasn't. And as much as we heard about the racialized fears of this and the harassment, I have to concede, looking back on it, that the overarching demographic nature of that protest was not race, it was class. That this was a popular act of civil disobedience, and they were mostly Canadians who were much more hardly hit by the COVID regulations than I was.
I will tell you, most people here have been very civil. They have their strong views on vaccine mandates. There's concerns about the QR code, about government overreach, about media coverage.
This was a class distinction. These were the people who work in the service industry or in industry or in manufacturing or transportation or truckers who were hurting worse than white-collar professional class Canadians. And most of the things they were asking for, every country in the world, including Canada, soon did. The notion that this was just like a huge, violent protest, I think, is unfounded. It was not the violence that it was described as. The arson, that was not a real story. One of the most embarrassing corrections I've ever had to issue, we got this clip of a guy saying, oh, they're calling us white supremacists. I'm proud of it. I'm a white supremacist. And we ran that because I thought, oh, my God, look at this. They're celebrating white supremacy. And it turned out it was a black guy. And the joke was, as if I'm a white supremacist. And it was a lesson for me, and confirmation bias is real. And when you go into a story thinking that you're going to see something, you're going to look for things that conform to that. And ultimately, I had to give my head a shake. And I'm sorry, Kariloff and everybody else who denounced the New York Times. The New York Times was right. They were arresting people at gunpoint, indigenous people at gunpoint. So we're still living in two Canadas, where I think that a lot of people still look back on that as like our January 6th and an absolutely illegitimate thing that happened. And I think until we actually start to listen to some of these people who are outraged by the idea that Tamara Leach will be locked up for 7 years, Chris Barber for 8 years, we're not going to get anywhere in terms of the division in this country.
Well, I think both camps are living in kind of false realities. The convoy enthusiasts, it's their Woodstock. They will go back to it for the rest of their lives with these highly embellished memories of its significance, of its beauty, what have you. And that is just as false and incorrect, I think. I'm reminded of that line from All the President's Men, where Deep Throat is explaining the Watergate conspiracy, and he says,
"Forget the myths that the media has created about the White House. The truth is, these are not very bright guys, and things got out of hand."
And that basically describes, to me, what happened in Ottawa at the convoy. You know, you had these people come in with this deluded manifesto. They were going to govern with the governor general. They were going to overthrow the governments. And then these other people, it was about vaccines. But of course, most of the vaccine mandate issues were at the provincial level. It was a national festivus. It was a grievance party for people who were just mad about things.
And at the festivus dinner, you gather your family around and tell them all the ways they have disappointed you over the past year.
I take your point about class.
But isn't that how protest works? Like this way, like, oh, you're not protesting right. You're going to the wrong level of government. Like, I didn't have sympathy for that because it's, look, these people are making themselves known. They're more successful at protesting than a lot of other protesters. They're getting a lot of national attention, and they did change politics. They changed who the leader of the Conservative Party was. They certainly, I think, expedited Trudeau's decision-making. So to wag your finger and say, like, oh, you don't understand and how this works, that feels like a classist thing too.
No, it's not a classist thing. It's just a knowing things versus not knowing things thing. Like, I will wag my finger at anyone who protests at the wrong level of government. This is like basic civic stuff. But I take your points. I take your point that things didn't go as badly as we thought they would. But it's a bit of Monday morning quarterbacking, and it's a bit of the hindsight bias in action, where we gaslight ourselves because things went a certain way. And I don't think that's fair to where we were at that moment in time. Things were dangerous. We just had, like you said, January 6th. There was this sense of unease. And Matt Gurney, for example, did some really good reporting where he went to the staging area for the convoy and found some pretty shady characters with some pretty dangerous affiliations and attitudes. And I think it's great that things were nonviolent. I think it's important to recognize that Tamara Leach and Chris Barber counseled nonviolence to their supporters, but it could have gone sideways. And so I do think that we need a national reckoning on this, that we need to try to bring those two worldviews closer into alignment. We're never going to get them on the same page. And maybe part of that is showing some leniency to Leach and Barber. But for the folks that got caught up in that, who found meaning in that, and to me, that was, I think, more than anything, what it was we were in a moment where people were locked in there. They were staying at home. We had COVID. We couldn't see our friends. And this protest movement gave people meaning. It gave them an opportunity to be around other people. It was socially rewarding and gave people a sense of belonging.
None of those things you just said sound very bad.
They're not bad.
That sounds like what we were told at the time. You guys in the media are mischaracterizing us as a bunch of monsters. This is a party. This is a freedom party. That's what we were being told. We're like, no, this is going to go bad. And I read that Matt Gurney piece, and I thought, like, at the time, I thought, this is incredible reporting. I'm incredibly concerned. You've got some shady characters who are sitting on all this gasoline and who knows what. And I have no specific complaint about the factual accuracy of that piece of reporting. Like, you're totally right. If something else had happened, then we'd be making a different sense of it. But it didn't. It didn't.
No, it didn't. And we should be thankful for that. But I don't think we should gaslight ourselves into thinking that it was peaceful or that it was just love and kindness and friendship. I know I'm contradicting what I just said. I was trying to explain why it attracted so many people and such a disparate kind of crowd of people.
Yeah.
And I think most people who attended that attended perhaps not in good faith, but certainly not in bad faith or with an intent to cause damage or cause destruction. But there were people involved in it who very much did have bad intentions. And I don't think we can kind of wash that away with one brush here. And that's the tricky part about making history and deciding what the official narrative is it's complicated. It contains multitudes. There was good and decent people involved in some fairly innocuous things. And there were also bad and dangerous people who have very antisocial attitudes towards the government, who are willing to at least consider the possibility of overthrowing a democratically elected government. And those things should not be tolerated.
I take your point, and it's a very delicate thing. Like, a party can turn into a mob in 2 seconds. And I don't doubt that if there had been a critical mass or just like a break in the armor and somebody had actually found a way in to start doing the wrong thing or get into the wrong building, that it wouldn't have all followed. Like, history can turn on these little moments. But it is relevant, and I think it's something that maybe we should even feel good about, that if this was our January 6th, it was a very Canadian January 6th, and it was raucous and disruptive, and it was harmful to people in Ottawa, but it was not a violent intrusion into government buildings. It was not an attempt to overthrow a government. It was not a violent event in terms of physical violence. That's all very good. That's good. Yeah. And we should actually feel good about how that played out. And these are people were losing their jobs. People were losing their sanity. I don't know if you saw this movie Eddington recently. I recommend everybody go and check this out. I haven't seen that time period of like early days of COVID restrictions dramatized and just what it was doing to people's psyches. And the first half of that movie, I don't think I realized how much I've blocked out what those days were like.
Is it worth it to combat a virus that isn't even here at the cost of being at war with your neighbors and your family?
And it's really something. It's disturbing and thought-provoking to see that on the screen. It's worth seeing that movie for that alone. It's hard to say anything with certainty looking back on it. The only thing that I feel with like 100% certainty is Trudeau should have come out and talked to them.
Yes, I agree. I think that was in some ways a turning point for him in his decline, but it was clearly a failure of him in his job as prime minister. You know, these people are not your friends. They're not your fans. They do not like you, but you are still their prime minister. And at the very least, you need to hear them out. And I think it would have been very effective. Maybe we would have avoided the Emergencies Act if he had gathered a cross-section of them. I don't think wading out into the crowd would have been tolerable from a security perspective, but if he had gathered a cross-section of them, sat them down somewhere in an official building in Ottawa and just said, tell me what you feel. I want to hear you out. I think that would have diffused a lot of those tensions, because then they couldn't say that he wasn't listening to them. They could say that he wasn't hearing them, but it would have been an important gesture. And I think he was just too bought into the idea that these were bad people. There's some truth. There's not a lot of truth, but there's some truth to that accusation of him that he had described them all as deplorables, basically.
The small fringe minority of people who are on their way to Ottawa or who are holding unacceptable views that they're expressing do not represent the views of Canadians who have been there for each other, who know that following the science is the best way to continue to ensure our freedoms, our rights, our values as a country.
I think he may have probably believed that on some level. And of course, he was intimately close to it. He was getting shouted at. I can't imagine what it takes to endure that kind of abuse. But again, that's the job. The job is to meet not just with people you like and who agree with you, but with people who you don't like and don't agree with you. And that would have been a good moment for it.
Max, on this show, you know the drill. We read the news. We read more news than you do. I don't know if we read more news than people out there do. There's probably people out there who read more news than us. But in case they missed something important, we duly note stories. What do you have to duly note today?
I have a good news story about climate change. There was a study that came out in June from an organization called Ember, which is sort of a leading global research firm into renewable energy. And it has discovered solar is now at a crucial tipping point in the clean energy transition. They looked at the cost of doing stored solar energy. So not just intermittent. This is the complaint that critics of renewable energy, including Doug Burgum, who is the United States Energy Secretary, he said, well, solar is great, but you can't store it. Well, yes, you can. You use batteries. And so Ember ran the numbers on the cost of pairing solar with batteries and has discovered that you can get 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, solar energy for $104 per megawatt hour in places like Las Vegas, Oman, Muscat, really sunny cities, right?
So, holy wait, is that good? I don't know. Is good?
That is very good. That is cheaper than new coal. That is way cheaper than nuclear. And it's getting close to the cost of gas. And that is like the true tipping point. Now, I'm sure skeptics, the folks who don't believe in renewable energy, will say, well, what about cloudy cities? What about Canada? What about places in the north? So they studied the cost and the efficacy in Birmingham, which is a very cloudy city in the United Kingdom. Solar there can cover 62% of their annual electricity demand. So this is a big deal, and it's a big deal because the trajectory of renewable energy costs keeps going down. Battery storage cost is down 40% in 1 year. It's going to keep going down because of technological innovation, because of pressure from China, which is just pushing on this. This is changing the game for electricity, not just in Canada and North America, but especially in the developing world. And that is where the rubber meets the road here, because if you're an oil and gas enthusiast in Canada right now, you are very excited about LNG. They always love to talk about LNG. Oh, you know, LNG is going to replace coal in India and coal in China. Well, guess what? They're going to just use solar and batteries instead. They do not want to buy expensive LNG, import it, regasify it, and combust it. They are going to replace it with solar and batteries. That is a trend that is going to be replicated across the developing world. So Canada needs to get its head together here. We cannot count on demand for our LNG, demand for our oil even, to continue growing indefinitely. These renewable technologies are just getting so cheap so fast that the game is changing, and there's nothing that Donald Trump can do about that. There's nothing that Mark Carney can do about that if he were so inclined. This is just raw, brutal economics, and it is coming for one of our biggest industries.
I mean, that sounds like bad news for some of the nation-building stuff that's being proposed in pipelines, but like really good news for the world?
It does. I think this is why you've seen Carney and the Liberals be very careful not to endorse a specific pipeline project, because they understand this. They understand the economics long-term mean that demand is going to start declining for oil very soon, for natural gas probably pretty soon, and the economics don't look good to the private sector. There's an interesting line in this report where one of the authors basically pointed out there's a small handful of countries in the world that export fossil fuels, and there's over 100 that import it. Which do you think is going to win out in the end, right? Is it going to be the 100-plus countries that would rather electrify, use their own solar, their own wind, their own whatever? Or is it going to be the small handful that need to keep exporting oil and gas? I think that the path of travel here is getting pretty clear.
Duly noted. That is our show for today. Max Fawcett, thank you for joining me.
Thanks again for having me on. Love talking hot dogs.
You can email me about anything you heard at jesse@canadaland.com. I read all the emails I receive there. Max Fawcett, where can the good people find you?
They can find me in The Bad Place on Twitter. They can find me on Blue Sky. And they can find my columns over at nationalobserver.com, where you can find, obviously, my work and that of my talented colleagues.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson. Our associate producer is Lucy Lomonier, who also did the fact check. Mixing and mastering is by Tristan Capicchione. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, some airplanes may need to carry fewer passengers or less cargo. When an airplane roars down the runway, its engines suck in air to propel the plane forward until it's moving fast enough to take off. But on hot days, air is less dense, and it's harder for the engines to do their job. So planes need a longer runway to gather enough speed or to carry less weight to speed up faster.
On extreme hot days, even today and in the recent past, this type of weight restriction has been applied, but we are forecasting that this will get significantly more frequent, more common in the future.
Johnny Williams, a researcher at the University of Reading, studied how global warming will affect the Airbus A320 jet at 30 European airports in coming decades. He found that many airports have long enough runways for the planes to take off on hot days. But at airports with shorter runways, like Rome's Ciampino Airport, the jets may need to reduce weight more often in the summer.
As a society, we are very heavily reliant on the aviation industry, from everything from our holidays to carrying freight to, you know, putting out wildfires. So it's really important to engage with this now.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.